American-style democracy is being exported to the rest of the world, but is it a model that's working at home? Socialist writer David North has published a book called The Crisis of American Democracy, which is based on the idea that we're about to witness a colossal transformation in world politics because the current state of affairs is unsustainable. David North is the chairman of the International Editorial Board of the World Socialist website, and as well as this volume, he's previously published a book called The Heritage We Defend. David North's current collection of essays about the crisis of democracy begins with the recent US presidential elections and suggests that one of the reasons why democracy is in crisis is because of the electoral system, which is flawed. Also flawed, he says, is the US media and the US economy. The third of these is where we begin. I asked David North if, considering the war in Iraq, he believed that the current level of US military spending was sending the country bankrupt.
Well, it's certainly contributing to it. I mean, there's been a lot of talk, and I'm sure you've heard it, about how America is this great superpower. Never has there been a country as powerful as the United States. One central theme of this book is that the last 30 years has actually seen a protracted decline in the global position of American capitalism, and that the phenomena of militarism, the increasingly unrestrained use of American military power, is not an expression of strength, but of weakness, an attempt by the United States to use military power to offset the protracted deterioration in its global position. In fact, there's a famous speech that Roosevelt gave in 1937, his famous Quarantine the Aggressor speech, which he delivered as a denunciation of the foreign policy of the Nazis. Many things which he said could be read today as indictments of American policy. Go to Google, write Quarantine the Aggressor, and Roosevelt's speech will come up. At any rate, one of the points he makes, comparing the United States to Nazi Germany, is that the United States spends a very, very small percentage, or at least at that time, spent a very small percentage of its national income on military expenditures. And he makes the point that the United States is proud that it spends its money building its infrastructure, improving the lives of its people, not on wasteful armaments and wars of aggression. That speech could not be given by an American president today. The United States is the most indebted country in the world. The trade deficit of the United States in 2005 will approach $600 billion. The net international investment position of the United States in, I think, the end of 2004 will be something like $3.3 trillion, nearly a quarter of its gross domestic product. These are figures which are unsustainable and are indicative of a profound economic crisis. If this continues, it will mean the ongoing destruction of democratic rights, the ever more ruthless subordination of democracy, of the interests of the people, to the global ambitions of really the money-mad clique that runs the United States. And again, I want to come back to this point about democracy and its social content. If we learn anything from history, it tells us that democracy is not compatible with a condition in society in which there are extreme levels of social inequality. Now, I give some figures in the book. Back in 1960, the income of a corporate CEO of a Fortune 500 company was on average 40 times that of a shop floor worker. That has gone from 40 times, a multiple of 40, to a multiple of over 500 in the present year. These are levels of social inequality which are staggering. Well, one works through their implications, and the sums of money are hard to even imagine. I checked recently a website which documents corporate CEO pay, and I just began going through it. I mean, what it shows, the income of the 1,000 top executives in America, the 1,000 top executives of the 1,000 largest company probably is somewhat in the area. Their annual income, salaries plus stock options, would be somewhat in the area of $25 to $30 billion. This is staggering. There's nothing which compares with it in the past history of American or world capitalism. The wealth is of such a magnitude that democracy is entirely corroded. I mean, the people who are at that level live in an entirely different world. I mean, money is there to do whatever they want. They can buy politicians, buy governments. And to believe that the political system can somehow hold itself immune from the corrupting impact of such wealth is to be really naive. I mean, was it not Balzac who said, behind every great fortune is a great crime? So this phenomena of wealth accumulation is of immense importance and very central to the crisis of the entire American system.
One of the quotes that you've given in your book is Senator Zell Miller saying that it's the soldier, not the poet, who's brought about freedom of the press. And you gave that as an example of a government undermining its own constitution.
Yes, well, that was an idiotic statement he made. It really is. I mean, one must remember that American freedoms were won in struggle against other soldiers. And I refer to Tom Paine or Peter Zenger. If you look at many state constitutions, as a matter of fact, you will still find injunctions against standing armies. I also point out that George Bush is often referred to as the commander-in-chief of the American people. He's no such thing. He's the commander-in-chief of the military. And that title, which is an auxiliary title, expresses the dominance of the people, the civilian population, over the military. It's being turned around to suggest something else quite different, that we have, a Führer and not a president. There is a tremendous decline in the understanding of what democracy represents and what its principles are. For example, in discussions, there have been many discussions condoned and encouraged by the media on the legitimacy of torture, as if somehow this is acceptable. It should be pointed out that the outrages in Abu Ghraib and in those which continue in Guantanamo did not take place in a vacuum. Respected journalists such as Ted Koppel actually held televised town meetings, or so-called town meetings, in which they attempted in their own way to condition public opinion to accept the legitimacy of grave violations of democratic rights. And even more recently, a book has come out by an author, Michael Ignatieff, very well known, called The Lesser Evil, in which he makes really amazing statements, such as the American people must trust their government in moments of emergencies. Well, the underlying philosophical principle of the American Constitution is that governments aren't to be trusted at all. That such concepts of democracy that people can write seriously, that democracy requires that the people trust their elected officials, and therefore don't have to subject them and all their actions to continuous examination, is indicative of a society in which democratic consciousness is in decline, or at least democratic consciousness no longer is to be found in those sections of society which hold power in their hands.
But there are some people who are being vigilant. From my point of view, I've seen a lot of books about the crisis of American democracy, like your book. These books are coming out one after the other. Are you suggesting they're not having any impact?
No, I'm not saying that at all. I think there are many books and there are many people who are clearly concerned and worried. And I think they reflect a growing popular opposition to the policies of the state. And that is a very, very positive phenomenon. I do believe that we are going to see growing public resistance to these policies. And I also think we're going to see ever more brazen attempts by the state and the government to suppress it. But when I speak of these tendencies in the U.S. government, I'm not at all suggesting that these do not encounter opposition. I think the government is very much aware of the fact that there's a very widespread opposition within the United States. There are still millions of people who have strong democratic beliefs. But, of course, it is a great problem and a great challenge to transform that embryonic opposition into a powerful and coherent political movement.
So have you experienced any of that firsthand? Like, what impact are you having and what resistance are you meeting?
Well, the World Socialist website, which I write for, is affiliated with the Socialist Equality Party in the United States. And our party in the United States did run a number of candidates. It is very difficult to do so. The two-party system is organized to prevent third parties from emerging. In many states where we actually had signed up thousands of people, we had petitions out and thousands of people signed them, and we met requirements which are very onerous, we were still often ruled off the ballot because the decision-making process is in the hands of the Democratic and Republican parties, which function as a together and collaborate together to keep opposing parties off the ballot. That also
happened. So your candidates weren't allowed to stand?
In many cases, they weren't. In some cases, we were able to obtain ballot status. We, in a number of states, in Maine and New Jersey and various states, we did have candidates on the ballot. In some cases, states, we won about 4% of the vote. That's not, of course, a large vote, but it is significant. And I think what we experienced is that there is a growing sentiment for a political alternative. I think that is definitely a tendency which one feels and encounters within the United States.
Do you think the word socialist is an obstacle to some people?
Obviously, it will be an obstacle to some people, and there's a great deal of confusion as to what socialism means. The betrayal of socialism in the 20th century, both by Stalinism, but also by social democracy, created tremendous confusion in the working class. And I don't think it's really possible to understand the very distressed state of public opinion apart from that historical experience. After all, 15 years ago, the Soviet Union collapsed. There were many people, certainly of an older generation, who had grown up under the shadow of the Russian Revolution and who had looked to that revolution as the beginning of a worldwide transformation toward a socialist society. Those aspirations were betrayed by the communist parties. And at the same time, others who believed in the possibility of a national reformist road to socialism, such as that espoused by the Labour Party here in Australia and other Labour and Social Democratic parties, saw those aspirations betrayed. And that created a great deal of confusion. So, you know, what we see as being really essential is a revival of a new socialist culture. That's not an easy job. It's a vast movement of political education.
And does that create a sense of social isolation for those who want to wear that label?
Well, I don't think the media tries to encourage that. I will say this, anyone who comes to the United States is always staggered by the incredibly low and crude level of our mass media. When one comes to the United States and one sees what passes for the news, it really is staggering. It's stupid, it's backward, it's dishonest. And an attempt is made to discredit any form of belief or political conception which in any way calls into question the legitimacy of the economic and political setup in the United States. But one has to be prepared to fight that. You know, Lincoln had a wonderful statement that, you know, you can fool some of the people all of the time and all of the people some of the time, but you can't fool all of the people all of the time. And in the end, the objective force of social crisis will have its impact on popular consciousness. If one doesn't believe that, of course, then one can't see any possibility of change. But, you know, anyone who's read enough history should know that this is not the first time in mankind's torturous development that things have seemed difficult. And yet, changes occur, and they occur very, very dramatically. After all, the Russian Revolution came at the high point of the First World War, where it seemed the entire civilization was being consumed by its own insanity, and a new path was opened up. I think we will see profound changes, and I don't think that they are so staggeringly distant in the future.
Oh, that was my question. I was going to cheekily ask when.
Well, I mean, if I, you know, I don't have a crystal ball, and I really, if I could answer that question, then you wouldn't have a right to believe anything I say. But I can say is that there are at work powerful forces. We are living in a world which has undergone colossal technological changes, changes in communications, changes in the organization of society. And yet, if one steps back a bit, they contain within them vast potential for progressive development. And I think if one does that and sees these miraculous transformations in technology, at some point there will emerge a political expression of these changes which are equally progressive. In other words, in some way, we're trapped in a political system rooted in national states and national interests, which is fundamentally obsolete when one considers the global nature of our society. Look at the tsunami, this horrible event which became at once a world event. And in that case, political leaders were scrambling to adapt themselves somehow, though often quite cynically, to the genuine sentiments felt by people all over the world. The developments in technology, the internet, computerization, and so on, have brought the world closer together and integrated it in a way which is quite extraordinary, and it's affected every country. It's profoundly affected Australia, which, as I'm sure most people recognize, has undergone vast changes in the last 25 years. So I think that the objective changes in the foundations of world economy, in the development of technology, are laying the basis for a new political movement, for which the past will be only a very pale indication of what is possible.
And in your lifetime?
Well, you know, I still have some time to go, you know, so I'm hopeful. I do believe in my lifetime I will see. I'll venture this prediction. During the next 10 years, you will see staggering changes in world politics. And there will be names and movements attracting mass support of which most people have never even heard today. That's my very, very firm belief. I think we are on the eve of a colossal transformation of world politics.
David North. And if he's right, we should be seeing signs of that transformation starting very soon. The Crisis of American Democracy is published by Mering Books. Now from the US to the Middle East. Like democracy in the US, Iran's current regime has also been the subject of many recent publications. Because in Iran, like the US, scholars and readers are seeking to fathom a changing political landscape. In his book, In the Rose Garden of the Martyrs, Christopher de Blaig makes a significant contribution to the understanding of Iran's transformative revolution. It's a memoir which offers a glimpse into the kind of Islamic apocalyptic fervour which could have something to do with that forecast colossal transformation of world politics. Here's Armin Sakal, director of the Centre for Arab and Islamic Studies at the Australian National University, to review In the Rose Garden of the Martyrs by Christopher de Blaig.
Iran has been subjected to much scholarly and popular study since the revolution of 1978-79, which replaced the Shah's pro-Western government with Khomeini's anti-American Islamic regime. Many of these works, some by established specialists and some by fleeting observers and storytellers, have sought to unpack the complexities of Iranian politics and society, as well as the country's place in a changing world order. The result has been a mixed bag of monographs and articles. A number of them have succeeded in depicting perceptively and sensitively the political and social, as well as foreign policy realities of historical and contemporary Iran, but many have not done so. Yet few capture one's imagination to the extent that one could call them enjoyable reading. Christopher de Blaig's In the Rose Garden of the Martyrs, a memoir of Iran, is one of these few. It is a beautifully written, high-caliber discourse which elucidates very engagingly many aspects of today's Iranian society against the backdrop of the country's rich historical tapestry. It is based on a well-informed understanding of Iranian history, politics, and culture, as well as the author's personal interviews, observations, and experiences accumulated over a long period of living in Iran. It is a memoir only in a limited sense. It is equally a book about Iran's transformative revolution and its consequences. It tells why the revolution occurred and why it ultimately devoured so many of its makers and turned sour for a good number of those who supported it and made sacrifices for it. It analyzes the manner in which the Iranians fought the Iran-Iraq War between 1980 and 1988 and eventually prevailed. Beyond this, it informs us of the Shia Islam, with all its peculiar religious and social dispositions, as practiced in Iran and in terms of its influence in shaping Iran's historical and current national settings. It's particularly instructive about the role of the Shia Islam as an ideology of political and social transformation and its exploitation for the purpose of regime preservation. It explains, often from perspectives of those who devoted themselves to the revolution and its leader Ayatollah Khomeini, as part of a religious obligation, why and how the hardline or jihadi followers of Khomeini have managed to maintain their original political ascendancy at the cost of stifling the efforts of their reformist factional opponents. It anguishes at the fact that the revolution has not fulfilled its original promise of a better standard of living and human freedoms for most of the Iranian people. Further, it makes it clear that Iran's troubled relations with the West, especially the United States, and the oddity of the Iranian regime and the international system cannot be fully understood unless they are placed in the historical context of Iranians' love for independence, mistrust of foreigners, and Western powers' insensitive treatment of Iran. More importantly, the strength of the book lies in Dibaleg's grasp of cultural and social peculiarities that distinguish Iranians as a people, and for that, a relatively homogeneous people in their own right. The book is saturated with both rational and popular explanations of the ways in which the Iranians do things so differently from other cultures. Never does Dibaleg fail to elaborate the centrality of Shiaism and